This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 21st, 1994. I'm in Ted Finman's office on the fourth floor of a law school, a quiet law school, we hope, today. And we are going to continue the interview that we began a week ago Friday. We were talking about your research, and I think we left off with the article that you and Stewart had written, Freedom to Dissent, is that the name of it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any other articles or research activities that you would like to talk about today?
Well, I can tell you what else I recall that I've done. And I think this came after the piece that Stewart and I did. I did some research on how government-sponsored legal service programs were operating in a number of cities. And that was funded, as I recall, by the American Bar Foundation. It was a grant from American Bar Foundation. And it involved really empirical research on how offices in, I think, five different cities were operating, rather than legal analysis. That turned into a monograph that the Bar Foundation published, and that was also published in the Wisconsin Law Review.
Were you solicited for this, or did you apply for the grant?
I don't recall exactly. I think it was sort of a mutual contact.
Did you actually go on site?
Oh, yeah. I traveled to five different programs and spent a few days in each one interviewing various people connected with the programs to try and figure out what factors had an impact on the kind of work they did, whether they did just routine work or were much involved in law reform work, and so on.
Do you recall if was there heavy involvement in law reform work, or was it more routine?
Well, it varied considerably from one program to another.
So it ran the gamut, in other words.
Yeah.
Any other research activities that you care to mention?
I don't know. Did we talk about the revised edition of the Professional Responsibilities Casebook?
No, we did not.
Well, that was one project that my colleague Ted Schneer and I did, leading to a second edition of that casebook. That was a pretty substantial project. And I wrote a couple of other pieces. And that's pretty much what I recall.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about the law school as an institution, or as a culture, for pretty much the rest of today's interview. Let's start out with the boss, with the dean. George Young was dean when you came. Tell me a little bit about George Young.
Well, George was a perfectly nice person. As a law school dean, as best I recall, and you have to remember, this was in my early years here, so I was paying a lot more attention to myself than other things in the law school. But my impression is that George didn't exert very much leadership. He just kind of kept things going. There was, over the years, some growing concern about this, which I think came to a head when my then-colleague, Lawrence Friedman, who had visited out at Stanford and was asked by Stanford to stay on permanently, and he ultimately did, but there was a strong feeling among a number of faculty people that George didn't really make an adequate effort to keep Lawrence, didn't understand its importance. And that, I think, led to George's ultimately resigning from the deanship.
Did, as far as you can recall, or do you know, did he resign voluntarily, or was he more or less helped out by...
Oh, I think he was helped out, yeah. Yeah, as I recall, some of the faculty went to visit with the chancellor about this, and that ultimately led to George's resignation.
And you had a few deans here who didn't stay, I don't think, for too long. Spencer Kimball came next. How would you characterize him?
Spencer was a much more active dean, and one of the things that Spencer did quite well that really no one else has done very well since is that Spencer and his wife had dinners for faculty. They couldn't have all the faculty at once, but they made an effort to get the faculty together socially, which I think is an important function of the dean. And, you know, we had gotten to be a size by that time that it was a really important function, because we wouldn't get together as a group on our own. We didn't. Not that we wouldn't, but we just didn't. Now that's the main thing that I remember about Spencer's deanship.
Were there any, and this not, relates not only to Spence, to Kimball, but to the others we'll be discussing, were there any major issues confronting his deanship, any major challenges that he faced that you can recall?
There may well have been, but I don't recall any.
Why did he leave the deanship?
Well, I don't really know. He had a good opportunity.
Is he the one who went to Chicago?
He went to the University of Chicago. And I think when he went, his job was part at the law school and part as head of the American Bar Foundation.
That's my
recollection.
Yeah, he still lives in Chicago, doesn't he?
Yes, I believe so.
I think I should make a trip to Chicago one of these days and talk to him.
Yeah, he'd have interesting things to say, I think.
And he was here before he became dean?
Or was he came here as dean.
Okay.
I think that he was on the faculty at University of Michigan Law School at the time he came here, but I don't recall that exactly.
Okay. I can certainly check that out. Following him was Charles Bunn.
No, not Charles Bunn, George Bunn.
George Bunn. How did I get Charles?
Yeah.
George Bunn.
Yeah.
Tell me about him.
My own personal view is that George was not a very good dean. He had a strong belief in clinical education, which he pushed very hard as dean. And aside from the merits of what he wanted to do, I don't think he handled very well trying to do it in terms of getting the faculty together and behind it.
So he was not able to develop that collegiality that Kimball had been?
I think not, right.
Had he been an outsider?
Yes, as I recall, he came... I don't recall whether... I think he came here on the faculty before he became dean, but I'm not positive about that. Whether he came here to the faculty first or came here as dean, he came from law practice, I think maybe with the government, but again, I'm not sure about that.
And I suspect that when Kimball left, he left voluntarily to
this
nice position at Chicago, and he certainly could have stayed.
Sure.
What was Bunn's ultimate fate with the law?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I just don't remember.
And he was replaced by an insider this time.
By Orrin Halstead. Right.
How did that whole thing come about?
You mean how did Oren become?
Yeah.
Well, there was the usual process of searching for a dean. And as you know, I was a candidate. And there were, I think Shirley Abrahamson was under consideration at that time. My recollection is that Shirley, after a while, ultimately decided that she didn't want to be dean and took herself out of contention. I don't remember who the outsiders were. Oren was picked really because there wasn't any outstanding person who appealed both to the faculty and the chancellor at that time. And Oren was picked kind of as a caretaker for a while, and that indeed was how he functioned. He had been associate dean for a number of years, a job in which he functioned quite well. It's not a job that calls for a lot of leadership. It required the skills that he had, but he didn't.
What were Oren's major strengths as a dean, from your perspective?
Well, we didn't have any, as best I recall, we didn't have any divisive controversies while he was dean, as best I recall. And you know, if you talk about real strengths, I don't think he had strengths as a dean.
Any weaknesses that you think hurt him?
Well, insofar as the law school could have used some leadership, we didn't get it. You know, someone to think about where the law school was going and develop some ideas about directions and bring these to the faculty and get the faculty thinking seriously about the future of the law school, which is always an important kind of thing, didn't happen.
Now, he was dean for a fairly long time, wasn't he?
Several years.
Yeah, it's like when Burge was appointed the caretaker president back in 1918 for a year or two, and he ended up staying until 1925. Why did Oren end up staying so much longer than he might have, than you would expect a caretaker to stay?
Well, I'm not sure. Certainly, partly because as long as things are going along smoothly, the faculty isn't going to be actively looking for change. I don't know what triggered looking for change. I don't remember.
You said that Oren helped the department function as a unit. That isn't quite what you said, but
no,
but the implication was that there, or at least that, as I perceived them, there might have been some factions in the law school that he helped bring together. Is that an accurate characterization or not?
Well, let me just think back. Let's see, Cliff Thompson came after Oren, right? Well, there were factions in the law school, yeah. I don't know that Oren brought them together very much, but there certainly were factions in the law school. There was a faction, I suppose you might say, led by Dave Trubeck. And you might characterize it as a semi, I won't characterize it that way. Dave Dave was very active in promoting research and trying to raise money and developing Legal Studies Institute. And if I recall correctly, Orrin did appoint Dave as an associate dean and, you know, give him time and some money to develop the law school's efforts in that direction. And that was probably a very good thing. You know, that wasn't Orrin's idea. Orrin was led to that by Dave and others. Partly the factionalism was a matter of personalities. And I don't know whether Dave was a candidate for the deanship at the time that Orrin was appointed dean, or whether he got into the picture only the next time, but I think he was.
As you were.
As I was, right. But there were personality, and I think it was primarily a matter of personality conflicts within the law school. Combined with some disagreement about the direction that the law school should be taking, and some perception, not incorrect, of Dave as representing a certain school of thought within the law school world, with whom some people disagreed sharply and others disagreed somewhat, and so on. In the law school world at that time, there were political disagreements and cliques that had developed in lots of places, in some places a lot sharper than here, but there was something of that going on here.
Did Orrin leave of his own volition, or did his caretaking reign just sort of mutually come to an end, or how did that come about?
I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah. But we then had the next search, which included possibly Dave Trubeck, certainly yourself, and an outsider, Cliff Thompson. Mm-hmm. What do you recall about that whole process and Cliff's being appointed?
I'm trying to remember. I think, you know, Cliff obviously was attractive to a lot of faculty and attractive to me. I like Cliff, and I thought he was quite a good dean. I don't think that either Dave or I were really serious contenders at that time. My time had really passed, and there were too many people in the law school who were very adamantly opposed to Trubeck.
Hmm. So, in a way, Cliff was...
I don't remember who was on the final list, whether there were other outsiders. We certainly interviewed a number of other outsiders. That's my best recollection.
In your opinion, why do you think Cliff was brought here? What do you think his primary function was? Why did they hire him, in other words?
Oh, gee. I mean, what that's asking really is, what did Cliff and the Chancellor talk about when the Chancellor interviewed Cliff and asked him, what do you want to do if you become dean?
Let me put it a different way.
I don't know.
Well, were there any issues or any things that Cliff had on that Cliff might have had on his agenda from day one?
Well, I think raising outside money, which really beginning a serious campaign of that sort for the law school, may have been on his agenda from the beginning, because it certainly is something that he did do, and do quite well, I think. And it's not something that we had done to any significant extent before. In terms of any particular intellectual directions for the law school, no, I don't think he had anything on his agenda. If anything, his agenda would have been to keep things open to different kinds of perspectives, not to turn the law school into any particular direction, but just to keep it open.
I've heard many people talk about the new job, as it appears for chancellors and for deans so often, is heavily reliant on raising funds. Was this sort of the beginning of that trend, do you see, in law school?
I think that's right. In the law school, that it was. It had begun to a limited extent in raising research money, because Dave Trubeck had moved in that direction, and we created the Institute for Legal Studies. I think that was before Cliff came here. But Dave was beginning to raise some research funds from foundations and grants, and put a lot of effort in that direction. But Cliff was probably the one who began any serious effort to raise substantial amounts of money for general law school purposes, for professorships and such.
What about the building project that's seems to be kind of an endless thing in the law school?
Well, we would have been talking about that certainly during Cliff's deanship. I don't remember whether we were talking about it during Oren's deanship. We could have been. And the one question there was whether to try and do something with this building, or to move to a different location and start afresh and build a new building. And you know, that was a question, excuse me, for a period of time. And there's pretty strong sentiment within the law school to do something with this building, because moving would have meant moving away from the main campus. And very few people I don't think anybody wanted to do that, and most people thought that that would be a definite, strong negative. How did we get where we are today? Well, it just developed over time, and I think you need the money, and as we began to raise money and saw the potential for doing that, we got more serious about what we wanted to do.
I can't recall, and I'm sure I could find out this information, but do you recall off the top of your head how much money you have raised for this building project?
I think it's the order of several million.
And this has been over the last 5 to 7 years, something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Now, Cliff left, and you hired a new dean, your current dean, Daniel
right.
Bernstein. How did that come to pass?
Well, Dan was well known here, because Dan had been, I think, the first Hastie Fellow here. The Hastie Fellow program is a program that my colleague Jim Jones developed, which brings minority law school graduates who are interested in getting into academic life here to do graduate work, and then to help them find academic positions after they've done their graduate work. And Dan was the first Hastie Fellow, and went on to teaching position elsewhere and administrative position at Howard. He came back here as a teacher for a while and then was on leave at Howard, but was on extended leave. So he was kind of an obvious candidate for the deanship at that time. Quite popular with the faculty, and you know Donna selected him.
Oh, that's right.
That was under Donna, and not to in any way detract from his obvious qualifications for the job in the first instance, but Donna was interested as well in hiring minorities and women for all positions, including upper administrative positions. But Dan would have been a very viable, worthwhile candidate in any circumstances.
Sort of a small question here. What is Hasty?
Hasty is the name of one of the first black judges to be appointed to the Federal Court of Appeals, and so this was just named in his honor.
So it's the name of a person,
right?
Okay. Let's talk just a little bit about some of the significant issues that have faced the law school during your years here. We've already addressed one, which is the building, raising funding for a building. Well, by the way, is Bernstein's job heavily wrapped up in fundraising?
He spends a lot of time on the road raising money, right?
So the job of the associate deans then become more important, is that, or more just filled with decision making, or?
Well. I think really what's happened is that there isn't much internal ferment going on. Insofar as there is innovation, it's by individual faculty members, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean that. As long as the administrative structure supports faculty members in their efforts, maybe it's just as well to let people go off on their own. But certainly Dan is not an internal dean. If and when problems arise, he's very good at dealing with them. But his job is primarily as an outside dean, working with the alumni, raising money, and so on.
Let's talk about the alumni for a bit. I think it was, I interviewed both Orrin Halstead and Cliff Thompson. I think it was Orrin who said that there really wasn't much of an alumni organization when he took over as dean. I may be getting that wrong now. But that the alumni organization has since really built up and become a vital force in the law school. Do you have any perceptions on that at all?
Well, I can't recall and compare the level of activity by the alumni over different periods, and I wouldn't call it a vital force at any time, including the present, except in terms of raising money and providing support for the law school. I mean, the alumni takes an active interest in the law school and looks at what we're doing and so on, and comes and talks to faculty and talks to students. And if there are complaints, raises those complaints with the dean and so on. So it may be a small catalyst for some gradual changes in some directions, but in terms of the law school's academic program, I wouldn't call it a vital force.
One of the
that may reflect my bias that I don't think it ought to be. Not, I don't have anything against alumni, but it's not their job.
This is not an outside-driven, alumni-driven department.
No, and law schools that are, I think, don't get driven in the right direction.
One of the other issues that I've heard talked about was the issue of accreditation. There were some problems with the UW and the, would that be the National Bar? Who does the accrediting?
It's the Association of American Law Schools and the ABA that work together on accreditation matters.
And the problems, I believe, were in the area of mainly the facilities and the library, was that?
There was a question raised about the adequacy of the library facilities. There have been more recently question raised about the excessive use of practitioners as lecturers in As I was saying, at one time or another, there were questions raised about the adequacy of faculty salaries. But in some of these issues, the accreditation groups raised, on their own initiative, and I don't think the law school was particularly happy to have them raised. Others, of course, we were very happy to have them raised. With other departments where an accreditation group comes in and says to the chancellor, that department really needs more money, everybody understands what's going on.
How did that, with the library, for example, how was that resolved? Did you eventually get more money?
I think we got some more money, but I haven't paid much attention to accreditation issues, really.
Affirmative action.
We were never in serious trouble. There was never, to the best of my knowledge, there was never any real risk of us losing our accreditation. But there were things that we needed to do. If we hadn't made any changes over the next 5 years, maybe there would have been a serious problem, but there was never a serious problem at the moment.
One of the other issues that all the colleges and schools on campus have been facing over the last decade or two has been in the area of affirmative action. Now we're going to talk about that on a campus-wide campus-wide matter when we talk about the university committee the next time we get together. But in terms of the law school, has affirmative action been an issue or a problem, or how has it been handled by the school?
I don't think it's been a problem. The law school is probably one of the best departments in the whole university in terms of its affirmative action record. We've hired a substantial number of women and a substantial number of minority faculty. I don't think there's ever been any serious disagreement within the law school concerning the virtues of affirmative action on the merits of individual candidates, as with the merits of individual white male candidates, there are always from time to time disagreements. But on the basic idea that we ought to be hiring well-qualified women and well-qualified minority faculty, I think there's pretty much been virtual unanimity on that.
So that there wasn't the need for committees or anything like that? It was something that was organic within the department and just came
when there wasn't any need for anybody to push it on us.
We were
out looking for opportunities, and when we had one year when we had a number of good candidates but not enough money, we went to the Chancellor Shalala at that time and got some extra funding so we could indeed hire more people than we otherwise would have been able to.
With the stipulation being that they'd be minority or...
Oh, well, they were for particular people. We had particular people we wanted to hire, but we didn't have enough money.
Okay. Any other, can you think of any other issues that are more or less law school-wide that have been the driving controversy or whatever?
Well, not really much of an issue these days, but it was... maybe as much as starting as much as 20 years ago or so, there was a lot of ferment in the law school world concerning clinical education and how much resources law schools ought to allocate to clinical education. Now, clinical education usually refers to education in which law students actually engage in some form of law practice. A related phenomenon in the law school world is practice training in simulated situations, but not actually serving clients in some sort of clinic. At this point in time, I think law schools are across the country are pretty well settled into whatever they're doing in the way of clinical education. And I don't think that there is either any great push to do a great deal more or any push to really cut back substantially. So kind of patterns have been established at each law school. I think virtually all schools have some sort of clinical education. Some have more, some have less. But there was a lot of disagreement in the earlier days about the importance of clinical education and how much resource we should allocate to that and so on. And those battles were fought and largely resolved a good while ago.
I know of the Center for Public Representation, for example. Are there was that set up to provide clinical experiences?
Yeah, that was part of the idea, but also that was under George Bunn's deanship, and he pushed that very hard because he thought the law school should be involved in public service representation. You triggered my recollection on a point of controversy within George Bunn's administration. I think all of us in the law school thought it was a good thing for lawyers to engage in public service representation, but there was serious disagreement about the appropriate role of the law school as an institution in taking advocacy positions on controversial public issues, which of course is what the center does. Mm-hmm. But lots of us, myself included, believed that it wasn't the appropriate role of the law school as an institution to be involved in pushing positions on controversial issues. It's not unlike the debate within the university about whether the faculty should have taken a position on the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Right. Was there a winner on that particular issue? Not the Vietnam War.
Well, the center was set up as a separate entity, and I think the law school was and has been reasonably successful in keeping itself as an institution separate from that.
Were there any other institutions, organizations, whatever, like the center that were started by under the auspices or with the support of the law school?
We have some clinical programs, and I don't recall when they first got going, but the two major clinical programs that we have are legal assistance for institutionalized persons, LAIP, which is a fairly substantial program for which we get some separate state funding on contract from the state, which provides legal services for prisoners as well as for people in mental institutions. And that a fair number of students get experience helping clients through that program. And the other main program is the Legal Defense Program, which represents people in misdemeanor situations. I think they may occasionally do a felony matter, but I'm not sure of that. It's almost exclusively misdemeanor, where law students, in supervision by regular lawyers who are hired by the program, get experience in representing people in misdemeanor situations. And we have a full-time academic staff law school person who is the director of that program. And we have some other programs in which students get, you know, some practical experience, but those are the two main ones.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about the deans that Spencer Kimball got this faculty together for dinners, things like that. Are there any school-wide organizations, seminars, other things set up to bring the law school together, or have
When I first came here, it was fairly common for there to be a law school table at Tripp Commons, and you know, very frequently there would be a group of law school faculty eating lunch together over there. This wasn't anything formal, it's just that it was a common thing to do, and different people would be there on different days.
It was a purely social.
Purely social, yeah. Over time, that just disappeared. We don't have any other regular, purely social function. We do from time to time have a speaker on some matter at lunchtime, sometimes from within the law school, sometimes from without, and the law school will provide lunch at that time, and we held those in the faculty lounge. Not sure, we'll have some sort of faculty lounge with a new building, and presumably those will resume, but that's one thing that in recent years has gone on a regular basis. We sponsor lectures by outsiders. We have some money for that and a law school committee that identifies good people to bring here and makes all the arrangements. That's not a social affair.
In terms of campus-wide things, the people who were here back in the 30s and 40s, they were all members of different dining clubs that were sort of campus-wide. Did you ever get involved in any of those?
No, I haven't. Some of my colleagues have been.
Or town and gown type.
Yeah, no, not that either.
We've talked a lot about the deans and about some of the professors, but what about support staff? Are there any particular people that you recall, like secretaries or librarians, who have played a real active, vital role in the law school since you've been aboard?
Blair Kaufman, our last librarian, who's not here now, not really support staff because he's a member of the faculty, as well as being the librarian. And his main job was librarian. Was a real dynamic librarian. I couldn't tell you what the specifics are, but I get this impression from what other people have said. The woman who was in charge of the secretarial staff in the main office when I came here, Nellie Davidson was her name. May still be, I'm not sure whether she's still alive or not. Everybody thought of her as being a very important staff person. She had a lot of responsibility for that, to keep that whole staff going and so on.
Is that one you like to stay on the good side of, if she was in charge of the...
Oh, sure.
Did she assign work to the people who were...
Yes, right. Yeah. There have been lots of good staff people who do very good jobs in terms of, you know, someone outstanding who had some special responsibility. I don't think of anybody else offhand.
We've all heard the term, the Wisconsin idea, sometimes ad nauseum. But in terms of the law school, has the law school, in your years here, does it have an ongoing relationship with the state, with the legislature, in terms of projects and legal activities?
Yeah, there have been some people who've been quite active in that respect. Arlen Christensen would be one. I mean, Arlen took a leave for a while and was... I'm not sure what his formal title was, but he was, if not Bronson La Follette's main deputy, certainly one of the main deputies when Bronson La Follette was Attorney General. Walter Dickey took a leave to be the head of the prison system, or whatever that job is called. I don't remember the formal title. People have worked with the legislature on legislative reform. June Weisberger, I think, and maybe Howie Erlanger did a lot of work in helping to revise, and Margot Melly working on marital property matters. Earlier on, John Conway, who's been retired for quite a while, had worked on reform in the civil procedure area. Oh, I myself was a member of the committee that the Wisconsin Supreme Court appointed to revise the Wisconsin Rules of Professional Conduct. A while ago, the ABA came out with a new recommended set of model rules of professional conduct. The ABA has no authority over this. It just makes recommendations, and then it's up to each state to do whatever it wants. But many states, after that proposal came out, undertook to study it and see whether they wanted to adopt it in whole or in part and so on. And so the Wisconsin Supreme Court appointed a committee to do that, composed primarily of practicing lawyers, but with at least a couple of academics, myself and fellow whose name I don't recall at the moment from Marquette Law School. And the committee came up with a proposal, which the court adopted pretty much as proposed. And then in the first 2-3 years after that, I participated in a number of continuing legal education programs that focused on the new rules to explain what the changes were to various parts of the bar.
So there has been an ongoing,
yeah,
strong relationship.
Yeah.
For some reason, sometimes at the end of sections, you sort of tag things on, and I notice on my format, the one thing we haven't discussed, we probably should have discussed it earlier, relates to the interdisciplinary aspect of the law school and the creation of, was it a bioethics person or a...
Oh, okay.
Issue, or how did that, when the law school and the medical school worked together?
There'd been interest in the legal aspects of medical school, or I shouldn't say medical professional problems, and there are many of them that have legal aspects. I've been interested in that for quite a while, and the medical school developed a bioethics program and wanted to have a law-trained person involved in that, and so was interested in finding someone who could be part-time law school, part-time medical school. We had a couple of different people visiting here in different capacities who worked some in that area and may have worked partly with the medical school, I don't recall. But the medical school had proposed to the law school that we try and find someone. There was some controversy about this for a while, because the main medical school person involved in this, Norm Faust, was liked by some people in the law school and strongly disliked by other people in the law school. He was perceived as having his candidate, and other people in the law school were perceived as having their candidate, who was the wife of someone that the English department wanted to hire. And there was a lot of controversy of that sort, and things were really at a standstill. Finally, we appointed a joint search committee of the Norm Faust and Dan Wickler, who is in the philosophy department but was involved in the medical school's bioethics program. And Ann Althaus of the law school and myself, and I chaired that committee, and we conducted a very extensive search, and it came down to the situation where there were really two good people, and the medical school would be happy to have both of them. There was one person who the medical school people, Faust and Wickler, had previously worked with substantially and really wanted. But we also came across another person who they were quite impressed with and really wanted. Well, there was only money at that point for one person. But we managed to put together enough money to make an offer to both of these people. They'd both be, in effect, although the formal arrangements were somewhat different, in effect, they would both be half-time law school and half-time medical school. and we got some money from, God, I can't think of the name of the institute. Terrible how names escape, and I can't
remember it while you're having dinner tonight.
Yeah, okay. But they kicked in a chunk of money with the understanding that these people would provide some services there. And I'll have to take a look in the staff directory, and maybe I can, so we can fill this in. Indeed, if you want to stop it for a moment, let me do that. The other source of funding was the Biotechnology Center. Dick Burgess, who is the director of that, agreed to provide some additional funding, and together with that and a little bit more from both the medical school and the law school, we were able to hire these two people. And since there was a faction within the law school that was very strong for one of them and happy to have the other, and another faction that was very strong for the other but willing to have the first, it worked out beautifully. And it was, if I may say so, a real coup.
About what year was that?
Well, that must have been 4 or 5 years ago. I could tell you quickly by taking a look.
No, that's okay.
The names of the two people we hired are Alta, A-L-T-A, Charo, C-H-A-R-O, and Alan Weisbard.
That's a pretty big field. That's an emerging field, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, lots. I want to make sure I got the names right this time.
Yeah, I think I saw one of them speak at a round table. It was really fascinating. Any other campus-wide interdisciplinary undertakings involving the law school that you can think of?
Oh, gee, we have all kinds of research projects with faculty from other departments. There have been a number of law school people involved in work with the Poverty Institute. We have several professors from other departments. Three come to mind: sociology, political science, and history, who have courtesy appointments on our faculty. Those are the main things I think of.
Stan Cutler in history.
Stan Cutler, Joel Grossman. There are others, I just don't think of their names immediately.
Okay, that covers the area of the law school. We're going to move on to governance matters next time, and we'll talk about some early governance and your involvement on the divisional block term.